KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, Alaska, and K201DA 88.1 FM King Cove.
I'm repeating at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1.
Consider a gift of stock to Alaska Public Media. You may avoid paying capital gains tax and receive a deduction. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/stock or contact your financial advisor.
Alaska Public Media presents this special broadcast of Paleo Nerds. Outdoor Explorer will return later this summer.
Ray?
Oh, damn it, it's a bright and sunny day here in Ketchikan.
No, you're lying.
Oh, it is. It is, actually. It is, but it says the sun will only last for a couple hours.
Well,
so
guess what?
I gotta go.
It's gray and foggy here and cold. It literally is a Ketchikan morning here.
Wow.
Yeah.
Global warming or whatever. Climate change.
I think it's global warning.
Yeah, something. We're getting the message loud and clear. But yeah, so a bright and sunny day, but I understand you might be traveling soon yourself.
Yeah, I'm going to go to Paris.
You mean Paris?
Paris. Yeah, I lived there when I was 20.
What?
Yeah.
I lived in Paris
in 1977. I was a street performer and got work in a nightclub. And I performed at 2 in the morning, 5 nights a week. And I made, this was before the Euro, I made a lot of money. And it was in the Pigalle section, which is right near the whole Moulin Rouge area of, the Moulin Rouge nightclub in Pigalle. So I lived there for 3 months. And I'm going back after all these years.
Wow. Well, that's pretty hip. I've been to Paris once in 1977, went through
there
a couple of times. Are you that guy? You're that guy. You were down in the subway there?
Like, no, you know, I was doing mime and magic in front of the McDonald's on the Champs-Élysées, believe it or not. That's what I was doing.
Wow.
So I'm going to go visit the Museum of Comparative Anatomy, which is the famous institution. Remember Cuvier?
Cuvier?
Yeah, Cuvier was part of. He kind of is the father of paleontology.
I do know of Cuvier. He's kind of a big deal, and he's one of the first fellows to realize that, you know, things have gone extinct, and there were all these animals that used to be around.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, so the glaciers carved. So yeah, there's this great collection. The French have been collecting things. I know Napoleon went and grabbed a few things around the world.
Napoleon, I believe, made Cuvier his royal paleontologist or some sort of...
Right.
Yeah.
And so actually one of the war treasures they brought back was the first mosasaur. I remember that. And there was actually, when Napoleonic troops moved into the Netherlands, I believe, there was a mosasaur they all knew about. And they actually, it's a really great, fun story because they ended up trading some champagne to get the mosasaur.
That's right. I remember that.
To drag it back to Paris. And I think the Dutch want it back. And you might, you know, put in a word while you're there.
Okay, yeah. Well, I am visiting Amsterdam after, so...
Well, okay, you take it with you in your luggage.
Yeah, okay, I'll take a tooth. I'm hoping to meet Dr. Alain Pradel. And tell me about him.
Alain Pradel. Yeah, Alain. Yeah, you know, I just was putting it all together here. I'm so excited that you're going to Paris, and I'm so jealous. But I said, you've got to look up this guy, Alain Pradel, who is a PhD, but I met him, I think, I'm trying to, it's vague, it's way in the deep chambers of my mind, I think in 1998 in New York City.
Uh-huh.
And the Discovery Channel flew me out. I was kind of a TV guy for a little bit there.
Uh-huh.
And I did a show on prehistoric sharks.
Right.
And so he's a shark guy. So he was actually studying with John Mazie, Dr. John Mazie at the American Museum of Natural History. And they flew me out to be on camera with John Mazie. And by the way, there was this French kid in the other room who was working on...
Kid?
He was working on... he's younger. Well, everybody's younger than me now, but he was working on Enneopterygians. So these cases of these little ratfish-like creatures, these beautifully preserved brain cases from Manhattan, Kansas.
Right.
So he's in Manhattan, New York City, working
on the Enteropterygians, are they Devonian?
Enteropterygians are, they go back to...
Pre-shark?
Well, so this is the thing.
Okay.
So we're going way back in time, in the Devonian, probably in the late Devonian, and going into the Mississippian and the Pennsylvanian ages, so the Carboniferous, as the Europeans call it. there was great diversity among the cartilaginous fishes,
right?
I.e. the sharks and the shark family. And there's a great split that happens way back in deep time between what we think of as sharks today, the elasmobranchs, the shark, living sharks, and the ratfish, also known as ghost sharks.
Right.
Who are, there's a split between that group. And so there's all this tremendous diversity among the cartilaginous fish. And they're also called the chondrichthyans. So right. Osteichthyans, bony fish, these are the cartilaginous, chondros, meaning cartilage. So he's working on these ratfish sort of things.
And you love the ratfish.
I love ratfish Ray. Because I am ratfish Ray. So this is why I'm so excited that you go on there. But anyways, so I met him in 98. He's actually studying. He's working on his PhD, I believe, with John Maisy. You can clarify some of this when you meet Alan. But years later, all along the way too, I became obsessed with the buzzsaw shark, is what we call it now, but the Helicoprion. So it's now known as the buzzsaw shark. We've talked about this in other shows, but I was, because I've been so obsessed with this animal, in about 2011, there was a guy who reached out to me up here in Alaska because he knew that I was obsessed with this animal, a young student.
Leif Tepanello?
Well, actually, Jesse Pruitt, who's a student of Leif's.
Right.
So Jesse was interested in the shark too, the big spiral of teeth. So Leif then gets interested in this big spiral of teeth. And so it's like, we can finally figure out this big spiral of teeth. But Ray Troll, being the enthusiastic guy who knows a bunch of guys, I know a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy, or a woman, or whoever, a person.
You're a networking paleontologist.
I'm a networker. I'm a connector. Right. So I realized, wait a minute, I know this young scientist who's now, he's gone back to France and he's working at the Natural History there, Natural History Museum in France, Alain Pradel. And I believe he was actually in New York City still working. He might have been back and forth, but he was actually back in New York. I said, let's get Alan out here to help us solve the mystery of Helicoprion.
Right.
Where it stands in the shark family tree. So Alan flies out.
This is before you had head scans when they found the skull,
right,
or the cartilaginous
right
skull.
Before. So the scanning happened. And right, there's all this stuff inside, and Leif Tepanella and Jesse, we had it scanned. Dominique Didier actually found the money.
Right.
So these are all these connections. She got the money to help have it
our
scanned.
Our previous
guest. Yes, they're all previous guests. So we've got this beautiful scan now, but we're looking at all these different parts. We're able to look inside the rock. So I suggest to Leif Tepanella, why don't we get Alan to fly out and join us at the great Buzzsaw Shark Conference. So we got everybody together in the room. We also brought in Cheryl Wilga and her student Jason Ramsey, who are modern day shark biologists. Alan flies in to Pocatello, and he's got this wonderful French accent, if I can lapse into it, very thick, and he calls it, I remember this distinctly in the bar too as I was interviewing him, he calls it Helicoprion.
Helicoprion. Oh, that's beautiful.
Helicoprion, I say, and Leif says Helicoprion, I say Helicoprion, he says Helicoprion. So in the bar, anyways, we have this great meeting of all these people interested in Helicoprion, and I just remember Alan coming into the room because he's the guy who really knows Paleozoic sharks, the chondrichthyans,
right,
how they're
right,
all related. He knows of all the different animals. I'm kind of
okay,
up on it, but
so
he really knows them.
So what did you find out? What was the result?
So as he draws out the chart on the wall, the big cladogram showing all the relationships and all these obscure Paleozoic sharks, and I'm tuned into this, he realizes, too, that the buzzsaw shark falls on the ratfish side of the tree,
really?
The holocephalan side of the tree. So we're sitting there sorting this out, and I keep saying he's got the thick accent.
So it's a ratfish.
It's a ghost shark. It's in that
right,
ghost shark
right,
group. So the closest, and there was like, wow, that means the closest living relative of Helicoprion, this gigantic buzzsaw shark, Helicoprion is a gigantic ghost shark ratfish. It was the ruler of the Permian oceans. It was the biggest shark. And I use quotation marks here. You can see them here.
Because these
whorls,
some of them, what was the biggest whorl ever found to date?
At least 2 feet across, maybe 2.5 feet
across. So that
would
have been, what, a 20-foot individual?
About a 30-foot shark.
Wow. So, and what was the identifying characteristics that caused Alain to say it's in the Chondrichthyan?
All right, so you are following along. So there is the characteristic thing. So here's the thing. Modern-day sharks, their upper jaw is not attached to their cranium, to the skull. It juts out.
They can go wide.
Go wide. You can see goblin sharks, even a great white shark bites out. In the scan of Helicoprion, there you could see the upper jaw now, finally. The whorl, everybody was always looking at the whorl of teeth, but in there, there's a cartilaginous upper jaw that was inside that. Alain sees that it is half fused, in other words, half attached to the upper skull. There's an attachment point. It's not completely loose like an... So therefore, all the holocephalans, all the ratfish, that upper jaw is stuck to this top of the skull.
Right.
So that means this is on that side of the tree. There's all this great diversity. So that was a pretty big thing. And that's why I wanted to nerd
with
you, but it shows that it's on that. So it's this whole group, you know, we think of sharks as, you know, there's 500 species of them. There's about 50 or so species of chimeras and ratfish left today, but those are what it belongs to. That's what excites me about it.
That's so cool. I really look forward. I have no idea what to expect, whether it's going to be an interview on his, you know, current research or a trip through the museum. It's going to be an exciting trip, and Paleo Nerds goes to Paris.
I like it. We could have along the Champs-Élysées. How do you say that?
Champs-Élysées. Oui, oui.
Yes. The Basque Sharks have a little cafe, meet him in the cafe, and do all those things.
No, I'm meeting him at the museum. So,
So there'll be all kinds of cool stuff. Worked with Philippe Janvier, who was an expert on the arthrodires and all the weird, funky placoderms.
Right.
So you might want to check those out. But I have no idea what Alain is working on these days.
Well, let me just fly over to Paris and I'll let you know.
Yeah. All right, flying out.
Okay.
Give me a report and let me listen to this interview. I'm so excited.
Oui, oui.
Oui, oui. Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Goodbye, Dave.
Well, I am in Paris at the National Museum of Natural History here in Paris, Paris. And I'm with Dr. Alain Perdel, who is the curator of the fossil fish collection at the museum I just mentioned. It's a pleasure and an honor to meet you, Alain.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
And we're in a very magic room.
Yeah, so this is the collection room in which you can find all the collection of the fossil fish we have here at the museum. I can show you some specimens, and you cannot see in the exhibition.
Right. You know our podcast, Paleo Nerd.
Yeah.
Are you a paleo nerd, and how did you become one?
I was not supposed to do paleontology. I was supposed to do geology.
Ah.
I did my study on geology at first. But in my courses, I had also this evolutionary teaching. And actually, I found it a good way to combine geology and evolution, and biology is doing paleontology.
Yes.
So this is why I did paleontology.
You have to know the rock to know there's a fossil in it.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to understand the environment of the past and where to find fossils.
Usually it's a great teacher that turns you on to the subject.
Yeah, clearly. And then I met Philippe Janvier, my PhD supervisor.
And describe who he is.
Philippe Janvier.
Is he from here?
Yeah, he's from Paris. He's now retired, but he's a very well-known specialist of Paleozoic fishes. And so
he's a fish dude, like you.
Yeah.
Well, give our listeners just a brief history of the evolution of sharks. And obviously it starts with the agnathans, which are the first jawless fishes from the Ordovician.
Yeah, you had some agnathans before, but the first time we have a skeleton made of bones and articulated specimen are from the Ordovician, with this example of Sacabombaspis from Sacabombaspis.
Sacabombaspis.
Yeah.
Woo!
All right.
From
there'll be a link to that in this episode.
From Bolivia. And so we had first this jawless, bony jawless vertebrate. And then came, in the Devonian, the placoderms, which were the first jawed vertebrates. So vertebrates with, again, a big shield on the trunk, on
and
the
big
head.
Big bony heads, yeah. with the faux teeth.
Yeah, yeah.
That looked like cartilaginous scissors.
And then, so they were the first jawed vertebrates. And then you had this group of what we call the crown jawed vertebrates, meaning that this group has the modern jawed vertebrates we know, like the sharks and also the bony fish.
Right.
So the sharks are inside this group. And within the shark, we have also different other kind of cartilaginous fishes, because the sharks don't have bones, they have only like...
Well, there's three types of cartilaginous fishes, which are the sharks, the chondrichthyes,
yeah,
the batidae, which are the rays,
yeah,
and then there's the chimeras, which are the ratfish ghost shark.
Yeah, yeah. So the shark, the rays, and the chimeroids are within this group, we call it chondrichthyes. Meaning cartilaginous fishes.
Right. And what's the difference between a shark jaw and a bony fish jaw?
The bony fish, they have dermal plates covering the braincase and the jaw. For example, for the jaw, you have the maxillary, premaxillary, dentary. This is dermal plates supporting
like
the teeth.
Modern fishes as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you go to catch a trout, the back behind the gill is soft flesh, but the head are these bony plates.
Yeah, yeah.
Very like thin, thin bone.
Too. Yeah, like us, we only have, like as human, the dermal plates, like the neurocranium, cartilaginous neurocranium is no more here. So you have this plate covering the brain case in bony fish. And in sharks, you don't have these bony plates.
Oh.
You just have this cartilaginous brain case. And so the jaws are made of cartilage. And there is no maxillary, premax, dentary. The teeth are directly into this cartilaginous precursor. Palatoquadrate and macular cartilage. We call them the upper jaw and the lower jaw. So this is the main difference between shark and bony fish. Bony fish, you have the dermal bone supporting the teeth, and shark, you don't have this dermal bone.
It's in cartilage.
Yeah.
And that's why so few, that's why you find the teeth.
Yeah.
But you don't find the rest of the skeleton. Cartilage is much softer.
Yeah, it's harder to fossilize. And also because the shark, they renew the teeth almost every day. So you have a lot of teeth falling during the life of the animal. So you can find a lot of shark teeth in the fossil records.
Yeah. So one of the titles of your papers, I just found it interesting, is called High Performance Suction Feeding.
Yeah.
What is that about and what did you find?
So in this specimen where I found the brain inside,
right,
the fossilized brain, we are lucky enough to have all the brain cave and the pectoral girdle and the bronchial skeleton preserved almost in natural position. It's ready.
What species of fish is this?
This is Inopera, which is a chimeroid.
Oh,
a ratfish.
Right. So it's a ratfish.
Yeah.
From what era again?
From the Carboniferous of USA, from the Kansas.
Okay, this is the Kansas where it's in Lawrence.
Yeah. Once we have the reconstruction of the brain case in 3D with the pectoral girdle, the bronchial skeleton, we can infer the position of the head muscle.
Oh, the muscle.
Yeah, right. The muscles. Okay. based on the fossa you can find in the surface of the brain case and pectoral.
So there's muscle attachment points that are evident within the fossil.
Yeah. So because also I'm studying the modern sharks and ratfish, I can infer which kind of muscles are and where in the brain case, and then you can do
comparative anatomy.
Yeah, comparative anatomy and functional morphology. And so it was my former postdoc, Richard Dearden, who did that because he was very good with this functional morphology study. And so we were able to show that these ratfish from the Carboniferous were not durophagous like modern chimeroids. They all
does that
eat,
mean durophagous?
It's meaning that they eat by crushing shells.
Oh.
And so this ratfish, it is the first example of a ratfish which were not durophagous, but instead they were suction feeding.
So they would suck in algae or filter, basically filter feedings.
No, no.
Suction mean like a catfish?
Yes, they were like sucking the prey and then smashing.
Oh, sucking the live prey and then smashing with the side.
With the teeth.
Did it have like plate-like teeth like a ray?
They had pointed teeth.
Oh, right.
But in a plate, like the base of the teeth were fused. And this is why it's also a ratfish, because the modern ratfish have the plate, the dental plate is made of the fusion of individual teeth. So it was, in a way, the first time you had this beginning of fusion of teeth, but still you had pointy crowns for grabbing or smashing the prey. And it's very interesting, not only because it was the first time we found a ratfish doing this suction feeding, but also because all the morphology necessary to do like crushing feeding, the rufagus were still already there, but not for doing crushing feeding, not for doing durophagus. So it's a good example of the evolution. First, you have this the apparition of characters, and then these characters are recruited to do another function.
Right.
Like for the...
flight.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, flight. You start from running, gliding, and then...
Yeah, or the first, like the coelacanth, they have kind of limb like us, like arms and legs.
Right. The coelacanth.
The coelacanth, yeah.
Right. But which it was can evolve into tetrapods.
Yeah, and first they were, so basically it was already there, but not for going to the landscape. It was, they were swimming.
Yeah.
So it's another good example of...
Well, that's brilliant. There we go. We've gone through the helicoprion in previous episode. Tell me briefly what your involvement was in helping identify what branch or what clade.
Yeah.
The helicoprion. Helicoprion. Helicoprion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where the buzzsaw shark fit in the evolutionary tree.
So thanks to this fossil we have studied with Leif and Dominique and other people.
And Ray Troll. Hi, Ray. We miss you.
Yeah.
Wish you were here, buddy.
So we found for the first time how this spiral fits inside the mouth, because we discovered the jaw, half of the jaw.
This is the lower jaw. Right?
Yeah, this is the lower jaw and upper jaw on one side, associated with the teeth spiral. And so when you compare to the shape of the upper jaw, it's very similar to a ratfish from the Carboniferous and also from embryos of ratfish, modern ratfish. So thanks to this character, we were like, oh, he has like a ratfish jaw. It's weird. And also because you have other characters which are shared with the modern ratfish. Like, for example, the base of the teeth are fused, as I said, with Inupera. This is the same thing.
So ratfish teeth are fused rather than having individual crowns.
Yeah, but still, Helicoprion has the crowns. You can see the crowns, but the base of the teeth are fused.
Fused into a spiral.
Yeah. So this is why we think that it's a ratfish.
Ray mentioned something about having the upper jaw being attached to the cranial bones in ratfish, and they're not in Condychthyes, in sharks.
Yeah.
Right? So he said you found it was semi-connected, hinting that it was in the ghost shark lineage.
Yeah. Actually, the ratfish, modern ratfish, they have the jaw fused to the brain case.
Fused?
Yeah, it's fused. Right. In modern shark, it's not fused.
But the upper jaw, you mean?
The upper jaw. Right. But you have some example in the Carboniferous of ratfish with the jaw which are not fused to the brain case. But it's attached to the brain case in a way you can find only in ratfish or in embryos of modern ratfish.
Right.
When the jaw, upper jaw, is still not attached, fused to the brain case in embryos. But it's attached to the brain case in different points, which are similar to what we can see in some fossil from the Carboniferous. And in the in Helicoprion, you can see the attachment of the upper jaw to the brain case in a similar way as some Carboniferous ratfish and modern embryos of ratfish.
Right. So there's a direct connection.
Yeah. This is why it's interesting also in paleontology to not only compare with other fossils, but to compare with modern species.
With extant species.
And also with embryos.
Right, because embryos.
Yeah.
Embryos show the development. They show the basal development of most creatures.
Yeah.
We look like chickens when we're a few weeks old.
Yeah.
Yeah, crazy. Referencing some of the papers that you co-authored regarding late Paleozoic shark dentition, the teeth, you said the buzzsaw and scissor-like dentition. So the buzzsaw, Helicoprion, and the scissors is the adestes.
Yeah.
Which is crazy when you look at it. It literally looks like a scissors, and it closed like a scissors with giant enamel teeth, individual teeth. But you state that they were for eating soft-bodied animals, cephalopods, squid.
Yeah.
So the question I want to ask, is there any evidence that was their prey? Or is it only through comparative anatomy of the shape of the dentition, the shape of the teeth, based on what a great white shark would eat today, which is basically, I'm sure they'll eat squid, but they pretty much go after warm-blooded mammals and penguins.
No, we don't have real proof that it was eating.
No, I know you don't have real proof, but what is the idea? How could you come to the hypothesis they ate ammonites or squid or soft-bodied prey?
Because we did, functional morphology analysis based on the attachment of some muscle. And so we can infer the position of the muscle and the length and the thickness of this muscle. And then you can infer forces.
The bite force.
Yeah, the bite force. And we showed that it didn't have the enough force to eat like hard prey.
Bone, cut through
bone.
Yeah,
yeah. So, so this is why we thought it was eating soft prey, soft tissue prey. Like
But wouldn't you think if you have a real sharp knife, it's effortless to go through a steak?
Yeah.
But if you have a dull knife, it takes a lot of bite force.
Yeah, that's true.
So why? And those teeth are sharp. They're sharp.
Yeah, very sharp.
Serrated.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you could cut yourself by leaning into it.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't it have gone for, you know, a huge marine reptile? When were the Helicoprion? Now, this is before the Mesozoic, right?
Yeah, this is during the Permian.
Oh, during the Permian. Okay, so what would be their prey if it were fish?
Yeah, there were different kind of, like, other bony, that's like kind of bony fish. So if he wanted to eat bony fish, you can find them.
Right.
But maybe he was eating like also some bony fish, but not very huge one.
But when you look at that buzzsaw and how it disappears into the upper jaw, it's almost a sheath.
Yeah.
How would it would have to cut its prey somehow and then swim back and open its mouth and let the pieces go down its throat, because there really were no mouth parts. Like when you eat a banana, we use our tongue to mash it, and then the movements in our mouth bring it to our esophagus, and then we swallow it using all these muscles. Well, I just can't. I'm trying to imagine a Helicoprion eating some large prey and getting it down its gullet.
Yeah, but when you look at the position of this spiral and the shape of the teeth, you can see that probably when he was eating something, he was like when he closed the mouth, the prey were directed to the back of the throat.
There's a force of direction toward the back of the throat.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So
okay. Yeah.
Maybe it was swimming very fast and
like a swordfish.
Yeah.
An adestes, the scissor.
Yeah.
That's another one I'm having trouble, but
yeah. We have trouble also because the specimen is not very well preserved. It's not in 3D. We did our best with what we have with Edestus, but there is so many things we don't know about this fish. And actually, I'm looking for more material, very rare.
Well, we'll be waiting for that paper. that expedition. We'll be waiting. Where was the asbestos found? In
the U.S.
Oh, in the U.S.
Yeah.
In phosphate, yeah.
Yeah.
Or phosphorus mine.
Yeah, like all the stuff Zengel did.
What was his name?
Reinhard Zengel.
He was out of the Field Museum in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he collected all this stuff, yeah, like asbestos and also inopterygium and some simoriforms.
Right.
Alan's wonderful but very thick French accent can be difficult to understand at times, so who he is talking about is Dr. Reiner Zangerl, a very prolific paleontologist, geologist, and once curator of fossil vertebrates at the Field Museum in Chicago. Reiner contributed to the discovery and study of numerous Paleozoic sharks and their cartilaginous relatives. He named the Enoopterygians and the Eugeniodontids, a couple of the only new orders of vertebrates established in the 20th century. Over his long career, he wrote over 60 scientific papers. He was my friend and a mentor, and he taught me a whole lot about ancient vertebrates. You can read more about him on his remembrance page on our website at paleonerds.com in a link on this episode's page.
Your postdoc time at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, you spent 4 years there?
Yeah.
And what were you studying at that amazing, amazing museum? Did you roam the collections?
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Oh.
I was working with John Maisie, who was my postdoc supervisor.
He's fish?
A shark guy.
Oh, he's a shark guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He had all this collection from the Arkansas, from the Carboniferous of Arkansas.
Right.
And also Oklahoma. He asked me to study one of these crazy simoriform shark from the Arkansas. So, again...
We call it Arkansas.
Arkansas, yeah.
Arkansas.
No. Again, I was lucky enough to study a very well 3D preserved specimen he had in the collection. And I did also field work there to find more specimen. It was one of the best time in my life studying in New York, a great city.
In a great museum. Did you enjoy the field work?
Yeah, I did enjoy the field work. It was for me also the opportunity to discover the deep USA and
deep south.
Yeah, yeah. So I had this view, like many friends, that you have the west coast and the east coast, and in the middle it's crazy people, but actually I met wonderful people there, wonderful landscape. So I did enjoy my time in US.
In my visiting many countries around the world, there are wonderful people everywhere.
Yeah.
No matter where you go,
yeah,
no matter what they believe, there's wonderful humanity and there are crazy people.
Yeah. And I was very happy to discover this facet of USA that I did not know. And
the South is beautiful.
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful. And so how did you come back to Paris? You were born and raised here?
No, yeah, I was not raised in Paris, but close to. I left New York because I had a position here in Paris.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
So you left New York to come here to the National Museum of Natural History Paris.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what are you doing? What have you been doing the last 10 years, Alan?
I was doing some research, some teaching, and most of the time curating the collection.
You had mentioned earlier there was a flood or some water seepage, and so many, many collection items had to be moved and had to be recurated and classified. Were you part of that?
Yeah, it was a huge work that took like maybe 2 or 3 years. And it was, it sucked my time a lot, so I didn't.
Time suck.
Yeah.
Do you teach anatomy like many paleontologists to earn money on the side?
No.
Human anatomy.
Yeah, it's part of my job to teach here.
Oh, right.
We have a master's degree here at the museum, so who are interested in evolution and comparative anatomy. So I'm teaching comparative anatomy, I'm teaching also paleontology. Yeah, it's part of my job.
That's great. Magnifique.
Yeah.
And do you have any secret projects you're working on now?
Do
you have any papers to come out that you can barely talk about?
Yes.
I saw you have 50 papers that your name's attached to, and several of them, yours is the only name on there. So well done.
Thank you. I don't have as much time as I want to do research because all the stuff I have to do, like teaching, curating and stuff like that, and supervising students. After the COVID, I did a lot of field work. to find new specimens. So I went to mostly in South America with to Bolivia, to Colombia, to Uruguay, to Peru.
Wow.
And with the team, like with Hector Botella from the Valencia University in Spain, from with Sebastian Oli from Belgium. I basically go there every year for 2 or 3 weeks. So we found a lot of new specimen, and now we have to study or to
prepare.
Yeah, to prepare to study them, and so yeah, many things, new things to come.
Very good. That's wonderful. So whenever I go to these collection rooms, I always say, "What is the holy grail of the fossil in this room?" And you just said it's not in here.
No. Yeah, I kept all the treasure in my office.
Let's not tell Cuvier. Don't tell him.
And actually, one of the things it was like a kind of magical story, because during my PhD, my supervisor gave me this fossil from the Carboniferous of Kansas.
Right.
And he said, "Oh, this is a 3D preserved brain case, but you have to find a way to study them, study it without destroying it." So it was
non-invasive.
It was the beginning of the 3D
tomography.
Yeah. So I did scan the specimen, and when I went through all the slices, I can see like something inside the brain case, in the cavity, the brain cavity. And at first I was thinking it was a piece of cartilage which was broken and displaced to the inside of the brain case. So I began to reconstruct it. When I did it, I noticed that suddenly it has the shape of a brain.
A fish brain.
A fish brain. And it was the first example of a real brain, fossilized brain, because before, to have inference of the shape of the brain, we did the cast of this
the cavity. Right,
yeah.
Right.
And based on this cast, we can infer the morphology of the brain. But it's not very accurate for the fish, because most of the time the brain is small, is very small compared to the cavity, and it doesn't really reflect the morphology of the cavity.
There is fluid, there is meninges, there's all types of stuff that doesn't indicate what the physical actual brain is in the living specimen. Because upon death, stuff evaporates, things compress.
Yeah. And also because it's very rare to find soft tissue preservation. So when I show it to Philippe Janvier, he said, "Oh, I'm not sure it's a brain. Maybe it's like the worms' tunnels."
Hi.
But like when I finished it, it was clear that it was a brain.
Wow.
A fossilized brain. And actually the brain is very small compared to the cavity. And it doesn't really match the morphology of the cavity, of the cast of the cavity. So, but like in modern fish, it was a big surprise. It was only by luck. We did not know that there were a brain before. So this is the magic of paleontology, with a new way of observation, with CT scanning and synchrotron scanning. We can go deeper to the internal anatomy and find new stuff we cannot see otherwise.
Is there any evidence of comparative anatomy with other fossils that show a similar fossilized brain?
No,
that could compare. Is this the first and only one, or only one?
It was for a long time the only one.
Wow.
And actually, last year or 2 years ago, they found other example of fossilized brain in a fish, in a Carboniferous bony fish.
Right.
Now we have 2 or 3 examples, and I just discovered, so it's still a secret, but I still...
well, this is going to go live.
Yeah. Well, there is more fossilized brain coming in the future.
Fantastic. And this is from Kansas?
No, it's from Uruguay, actually.
Oh, no, the one... Did you collect it?
No, it was collected back to the 60s.
Oh, and someone said, "Here, go dig through this, see what you can find."
Yeah.
And was it in 3D or was it smashed together?
No, it was preserved into a nodule.
Oh, right.
Phosphatic nodule.
Yep.
And it was a bit prepared mechanically, but the people stopped because the began to break some stuff.
Yeah,
so they stopped and wait for new technology to study the specimen without any damage.
Right.
And then I came, and it was the beginning of CT scanning. So Philippe said, "Okay, no, you can. We can study the specimen." It was actually it's not from the museum. It's a loan from the Lawrence University.
Right, in Kansas.
Yeah,
Lawrence,
in Kansas. Yeah. So I went back to Kansas for doing field work and to try to find these localities. And actually, the locality is no more available. It was covered by Walmart.
Oh no!
Yeah, see.
A Walmart.
Yeah.
What a travesty! What?
Yeah.
That's the erasure of civilization.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to go to your office and we'll see that. To see the incredible detail of this 3D printed brain, go to paleonerds.com and check out the images in Dr. Alan Pradell's Paleonerds page. You'll be amazed at the detail. And you know, when I saw the actual piece of rock that was CT scanned, it's tiny. It's about the size of a marble. I couldn't believe how small this is and the detail they got out of it. The 3D print is probably about 20 times the size of the actual brain. Check it out. You'll be amazed. What was the first evidence of shark? Now, what is the... I think it's called Dolodius problematica.
Yeah.
Is it still a problem?
It was a problem for a long time. But with the new technology, we scan them with John Macy. And so we have now more information about it. So it's no more as problematic as it was before. And
but it was part agnathian and part chondrichthyes, right?
No, it's a jawed vertebrate, so he has jaws.
It does have a jaw.
Yeah. It makes the link between what we call the acanthodians, which were a group who went extinct in the Paleozoic. And we assume that these acanthodians were the stem chondrichthyans. So they have bones, they don't have cartilage. The chondrichthyans have cartilage and no bones, but acanthodians possessed bones.
Are they the spiny sharks?
Yeah, this is the spiny sharks.
So they had how do you say it? We're getting things, I can edit this out. Say it. Say it, Steph. Cartilaginous, no.
Oh, man.
Yeah, the acanthodians were bony fish.
Right, but they had spikes, they had
Spines?
In bony spines on their pectoral fins and on their heads, but cartilage in their bodies. So they were a mixture.
Yeah. And the thing is that the modern sharks, they don't have as much spines in the body. They just have like dorsal spines. They don't have spines in front of the fins.
Right.
Contrary to acanthodians. And Dolodus is making the link between acanthodians and shark because he has cartilage as a shark, but he also has these spines characteristic to acanthodians.
Right.
So this is a very important species for the evolution of...
It is the basal shark, then.
Yeah.
Right. Completely. And why are we standing here? Why do you love this so much?
The sharks?
Yeah.
Because...
is it the evolution of fish or the evolution of sharks is your thing?
I was mostly focused on shark at the beginning of my career, but I discovered also other fishes from the same age. So now I'm working both in sharks and bony fish. Yeah, I agree, mostly on sharks. Why sharks? Because actually it was not a choice. My PhD supervisor gave me this subject when I began my PhD. And he said, okay, I have this topic on sharks. Do you want to study them? I was like, okay, why not? And I admit that it was not like my
passion.
Yeah. But I fell in love with sharks. So now I'm totally... comfortable with myself working on sharks.
So many paleontologists and scientists we interview on PaleoNerds start out wanting to do something else, but get thrown why don't you study frogs? And then suddenly that's their thing.
Yeah.
So show us the early sharks or agnathians that are interesting that you would like to show me.
Yeah. So I can show...
Because I have no preference in this collection room except for old, cool, dead stuff.
So this is the Spitzbergen collection from the Devonian. So we, Philippe Janvier did expedition there and found a lot of good specimen, agnathan specimen.
jawless vertebrate specimen. So here you have an example of all these crazy agnatons with the head shields.
Show me your best head shield, which, by the way, we're standing in a canyon of gray pull-out drawers in the collection department, and they're all labeled Agnathes placoderms. Agnathes placoderms. This is amazing. Scolonaspidae. What is, oh, look at this. This is crazy. Okay, from the Agnathans, the placoderms ruled the Devonian seas.
Yes. Yeah.
Show me some placoderm. Do you have any Dunkelostis?
We have, but this best specimen are in the gallery.
Yeah, they have an actual one from Cleveland, Ohio. Yeah.
So we have some specimen from Morocco also. Here, this is again like the Spitsbergen collection. So,
and that's the High Arctic, Spitsbergen?
Yeah.
So you have the head here of a tiny placoderms.
And it's interesting, placoderms are jawless fish.
No, jawed.
Oh, they are jawed.
Yes, they have jaw.
I'm sorry, they don't have bony teeth.
No, yes, they don't have real. Well, it's still under discussion, but for many years we thought they didn't have real teeth. But they have this kind of big plates mimicking the teeth.
Right.
Like with the pointed
the upper
plates.
And lower
incisors
almost.
Yeah.
They look like conchoidal fractures rather than individual teeth.
Yeah. So the jaw appeared in placoderms and along with maybe the teeth. And then you have like the crown jawed vertebrate with the cartilaginous fishes, the sharks and chimeras, and the bony fish like the ostrichans.
Did the first teeth originate with the chondrichthyes?
Yeah, or in placoderms, but...
Yeah, it's still... It's out for discussion whether placoderms really had enamel teeth.
Yeah.
The first teeth that appeared in the fossil record were from chondrichthyes.
Yeah. The funny fact...
The sharks.
Yeah, the funny thing is that the first fossil we have from shark are scales, actually, not teeth.
The dermal scales.
Yeah. And it's a kind of problematic because the teeth are easy for them to fossilize as well as the scales. So if we have scales in the Silurian, we should have teeth also. But we just have scales at first. So maybe the first shark didn't have like real teeth, but and the teeth came from the scales, like migration of the scales into the mouth and developed as teeth.
Well, would they have been predators? Would they have been filter feeders? Why?
Yeah, some of them were filter feeders. And yeah, maybe they just have like undifferentiated teeth as a scales into the mouth. But the thing is that the acontodians, so the stem chondrichthyans, they have teeth. Some of them have teeth.
Acanthodians?
Yes, the spiny sharks.
The spiny sharks.
Yeah.
Is it
acanthodians?
Acanthodians.
Yeah.
Get the proper pronunciation.
Well, I have a French pronunciation, so...
Right. Well, you say helicoprion.
Yeah.
Instead of helicoprion.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Leif says... Leif Tapanella says helicoprion. Mm. Ray says helicoprion. Yeah. And you say helicoprion. Which is great. I just mentioned that Napoleon must have walked through that Museum of Comparative Anatomy, which I did yesterday, which is really one of the first museums of the world and one of the first to show a relationship between different animals, different body parts. They were just feet.
Yeah.
Just a case of feet and paws and spines. Then there was you could compare skulls, and then one whole wall was organs. A baboon organ and a human baboon lung and a human lung. It was it was phenomenal. And so when I mentioned Napoleon, you said, what?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he went to Italy.
Yeah, he went to Italy for doing his stuff, we know.
Yeah.
And we have a good collection from the Monte Bolca locality from Italia. And again, Lagerstätten, meaning that the preservation is exceptional. The French story is that this specimen was given to Napoleon by Italian. Yeah. The Italian story is that it was stolen by Napoleon. So I can show you some specimen. It's like this preservation is exceptional. In the exhibition, you can see like even a fish eating another fish. I don't know if you have seen it.
No, I didn't. I would love to.
You can also have preservation of the pigmentation of the eyes.
So that's here in this room?
Yeah, we have some here.
From that Napoleon took or was given?
Yeah. So I can show you some of the specimen.
Yeah, let's see that.
If you want to see a picture of that gorgeously preserved fish that Napoleon's army apparently stole from Italy, it's on Dr. Alan Pradell's page at paleonerds.com in the gallery. There's tons of other photos there too, of course links to all the subjects we've discussed in this episode. I think you'll have a good time diving into that rabbit hole. Paris, très bon.
Now this is a question that Ray always asks our guests. But I'll do it because he's not here. We miss you, Ray. If you could travel back in time, if you can go to any epoch or any era, any period, any time, where would you want to go and what would you like to see?
It's an interesting question. I don't know if I have a clever answer to say, but I guess, of course, I would like to go back to the Carboniferous to see how wrong I am with the interpretation of the fossil, and to see all this crazy shape we don't have anymore, morphology we don't have anymore. But I like humans too, and back to these days, there were no humans.
Right.
So I guess if I have to do a choice...
I'll give you a time... How about a time within the last 100,000 years, and then within the last 535 million years. So that's the start of the Cambrian.
Yeah. I guess, well, I think I prefer to meet humans than crazy sharks and be alone with these sharks. Maybe back to late 50s, early 60s in US to see the origin of like
rock and roll,
this great music I'm into. Back to these days, it was the birth of many musical great stuff like rock and roll, soul music, funk music, and it was a great time for this kind of music.
Well, that's a great answer.
So I guess...
So really, screw paleontology.
Yeah, but it's still rocking.
Yeah. It is. And that was a pun. You just said a very good pun.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Then I have one last question. So as a prolific researcher with many citations and a teacher... What advice would you give to a student paleontologist or a future scientist that could help them achieve their academic aspirations? What did you wish you knew that you can, in a few words, have someone have a quick shortcut?
Yeah, it's a very long and hard way to get a position. And there is less, unfortunately, less and less position. Actually, in France, I think it's the same for every country. You have to be... tough to because it's a long way. Patience is one thing. And also how much you love paleontology or academics. It's something. It's the reality is another thing. So you have to combine everything, which is not very easy for everybody. So I guess you have to know yourself because like. For example, you have to, after your PhD, you have again maybe 10 years of going in different countries for 6 months, 2 years, 3 years, and you are in the age you want to create something with somebody.
Right.
So it's hard.
So you have to put off having a family for a decade.
Yeah, until like maybe 40 years old. So, and everybody.
Yeah, but we're all mature by 40. That's the best time anyway. You're too young any earlier to have a successful relationship in this day and age.
That's true. But it's not for everybody. So I guess you have to know yourself to go to this path. And you can do, for paleontology, you can do paleontology in different way, not only with academics. You can be like an amateur. You can find your own fossil and you can collaborate with researcher like Ray Troll.
Yeah.
He's very passionate with...
We call him Ray Troll. We can call him Ritual.
Okay. he loves all these crazy paleozoic sharks and rat fish. So
is doing paleontology, but not in an academic way. It's one way to do paleontology. And I know a lot of amateurs from...
He just had his first paper.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Nice.
He's first time his name is on a paper.
Cool.
Yeah.
Congratulations on to him.
The spike-toothed salmon.
Mm, cool. And I know a lot of wonderful amateur people in US who are doing excavation and fieldwork in their weekend or vacation time, and they found much more fossils than me. And they are very good in it, and I did enjoy working with them. And I think it's a good way also to combine like the reality of life with your love with paleontology, because there is not a lot of position, and it's a long way, and as I said, it's not for everybody. And I have many friends who are depressed because they don't find permanent jobs, so
right,
yeah, so it's a
yeah, so patience, hard,
like, patience,
work hard and know yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
Brilliant. Oh, that's great.
Thank you.
Great interview.
Thank you.
I was in Paris.
Oh,
what do you think,
man, I'm
Ray?
So jealous, but it's so cool that you went, and you studied well, my friend. You did it. It was a great interview. I really enjoyed it, and I was right there with you as you went through the vaults and stuff.
You know, all those pictures of the fish, and the Napoleon fish and the Lagerstätten is in the gallery on Dr. Alan Pradell's page on paleonerds.com, so you can see all those cool images. And him walking around his collections.
I thought it was kind of funny where you started kind of clarifying his English for him. You know, a little awkward. Like,
yeah.
Well, but he kept saying embryo. It's like, what is he? And then, embryo.
It all came out great. And he was a wonderful person. And I got to tell you a little story. I was in Paris with my partner, Steph. And after we visited him, we walked through these amazing gardens that were created by Cuvier, who was pretty much the founder of paleontology. And he was there during the Napoleon time, but he created this beautiful garden where the Museum of Comparative Anatomy is. We're walking through the garden. About an hour later, we're like, okay, we're in Paris. We got the afternoon to kill. Where should we go? So he said, well, let's find the nearest metro subway station. We wait for a car. We get on the subway. And right behind us, this guy comes in behind us. And it's Dr. Alan Pradell.
Wow. Okay. Well.
And we said, what? Alan, what are the odds of you actually coming onto our subway car? Is this your normal subway station? He goes, oh, no, I am off to rehearse for my band. I never take this subway. So it was the strangest coincidence.
That's cool.
Yeah, I was with him like an hour and a half before. What's the odds that we meet up at that particular moment?
It was cosmic, man. It was meant to be. And I love that he was off to go jam with his band. He's got a band.
By the way, in a black leather jacket.
He's the cool paleontologist. Yeah. But
he was very cool.
We talked a long time before you went about how the jaws work and all that. And I warned you that he would say hélicoptère. And he did. It's great.
It's poetry and semantics is what it is.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a wonderful episode. Congratulations. I wish I was there with you, but I got to be there, you know, via this podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're off on a few paleo adventures yourself, I believe.
Yes, I am. In August, I'm off to Montana for another dinosaur dig, and then I'm going to be traveling with my son through the Black Hills.
Wow.
I've really never explored the Black Hills, and I want to see Crazy Horse Memorial and go to the Black Hills Institute, which those guys are responsible for
all kinds of stuff.
Sue, the greatest T-Rex in the Field Museum, the controversial Sue, and also Stan, the T-Rex that just sold for a heck of a lot of money.
$30 million, but nothing compared to the Stegosaurus.
To the Stegosaurus.
Sold, but
what was his name?
I don't know. We'll talk about that on another episode, all right?
Yeah, yeah. $44 million for that.
I don't know.
Yeah, they've reached the price of fine art now. So it's, I don't think it's a good thing because it takes it away from scientific study.
Yeah.
All right, Ray. Signing off from not Paris, but from Ojai, California, where, of course, we're in the indomitable heat wave this summer season of the year 2024.
Yes, and I'm signing off from beautiful Ketchikan, Alaska, where, as one would expect, it's been raining, and whatever, I'm back in the rainforest.
Open your window again. I love opening the window and hearing the rain.
There it is. So soothing.
KSDP is generously supported by Precision Airways in Sandpoint, Alaska, offering chartered air services throughout the Aleutians East Borough and beyond. For more information on charters and prices, Theo is available at 907-989-4080. Precision Airways is a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
It's time now for your weather, tide predictions, and sunrise and sunset. Starting with your coastal water forecast,